New Hampshire history professor Stuart Wallace makes a pretty bold claim.
1763 was one of the most important years in New Hampshire history.
Wallace says in the early 1760s, a handful of very important events were coming together that opened the floodgates for New Hampshire's settlement.
That was the year that the French and Indian War officially ended. And what's significant about the year is that for the first time, the frontiers of places like New Hampshire were relatively safe because the French weren't there anymore.
Before then, the frontier land where present-day towns like Plymouth and Sandwich, Woodstock and Thornton are, was considered too dangerous to settle with the French and Indian War going on. But when the war ended with the Treaty of Paris in 1763, this land became open and attractive.
The wars themselves are interesting in that they introduced new land to the various ranging parties in search of the Indian foe. And as soon as the wars ended, these guys turned around and said, well, wait a minute, some of the land I saw when I was up there chasing the Native Americans looked pretty promising. And so proprietors quickly jumped on this land. They'd heard rumors that it was available, it was along river valleys, it was good land for settlement.
Plus, there were many others who wanted to come to New Hampshire as well, from south of the border. By then, Massachusetts and Connecticut were pretty much divided up, and the people were looking for new areas to settle. At that time, the North was one of the only available places to go.
New Hampshire offered at this time some decent transportation, and so you're going to see people moving up to Connecticut, up the Temajawasset, up the Bega River Valley. It's relatively close, and the land was considered to be fairly good, and they didn't really have other options. Nobody was there to tell them that eventually the Ohio country or Illinois or Indiana was available and would be good. That's another two generations away.
One man who capitalized on this opportunity was Benning Wentworth. He became the first royal governor of the colony of New Hampshire in 1741. That year, the north-south border between the Granite State and Massachusetts had been finalized. But by the 1760s, the western line, the one between New York and New Hampshire, which at that time extended through Vermont and all the way to the Connecticut River, was still hotly debated. With the end of the French and Indian War, border disputes between the two colonies fired up once again, and Wentworth took action. Retired history professor Jerry Daniel explains.
Basically, New Hampshire's the more aggressive, and what it does is begin to, at Benning Wentworth's urging, grant townships as fast as they can to provide legal priority. The common law system says you find a legal basis. The one that comes first is called precedent.
And so Benning Wentworth began granting towns in both New Hampshire and in present-day Vermont. But Wentworth also had political ambitions behind his actions. By 1763, a new king ruled England, George III. With a new ruler in charge, Wentworth worried about how much longer he would have his job. So Daniel says he turned to the frontier as an opportunity for political legacy.
Benning Wentworth, who was a real shrewd dude, knew he was probably on his last legs as governor. He'd been there for a long time, and he bought a lot of political support through these town grants. So you get a lot of people who are getting this stuff for not much. And so for Wentworth himself, has a double purpose. One, that's land which he thinks is part of New Hampshire, or at least hopes it will legally end up part of New Hampshire. He can bolster his own stuff locally, and if he gets chucked out, then he's got a legacy that he's been a good governor, tried to aggrandize, good for New Hampshire.
To this day, the 1760s still marks the decade of highest growth in New Hampshire history. At that time, the granting of a town was a three-part process. The first had to do with the actual grant, which was pretty much a real estate venture. A group of proprietors would receive a plot of land by the provincial government, generally about 6 miles by 6 miles.
And the reason for that is the experience of the first years of settlement down in those original four colonies a century earlier was that the best, most effective, functionally, size for a town grant was one in which everyone could get to the center of the town, to the church, to the village, in a couple hours. So 6 miles by six, 3 miles, hour, That's the idea.
Charters were inexpensive. Some were given away for almost free. Others cost the equivalent of about 5 weeks' ordinary pay. But once the charter was written, Stuart Wallace says, the work began, and the proprietors needed to settle the town in a certain amount of time.
They had to build roads into it. They had to settle people on the land. They had to have it surveyed. They had to set aside a lot for a church. Usually they had to set aside a lot for the Church of England, which they didn't belong to. There were stipulations on how they had to settle the land. If they failed to do that, they would lose their grant.
Those who were successful in settling could finally have their town incorporated. But this unique process of granting, settling, and incorporating complicates things when it comes to when a town celebrates its anniversary. Historians debate whether it's during the granting or settling or incorporating process that a town officially begins its first day as a town. But for this series, we go to the towns themselves. And if they're planning to celebrate their sester centennial, then we will be paying a visit. And our first stop will be New Boston. For New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Keith Shields.